Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, while not a consensus, we got another rate hold from the Bank of England this week. Where will they head next and when? And what will it mean for us? Also today, smart meters. Do you have one? Our Lee isn't convinced. Plus, we have a lesson in maths and get on the money therapist's couch. This time, it's the pitfalls of getting and overusing a joint bank account. Don't forget to update with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade-in shares, funds, investment trusts, and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, the base rate has been held once again at 5.25%. No great surprises there. It was what most of us had been expecting. What we were looking out for, though, was any indication of what might happen next. Simon Lambert. Welcome, Lee Boyce. Welcome. Simon, the fourth time for holding, but a genuine split in the MPC.
A genuine split. We've got six MPC members voting for a hold. They won out. We have got one MPC member voting for a cut now, which is interesting. And hats off to these two. We've got two MPC members who are still voting to raise interest rates.
Are they doing that, Simon, because they genuinely think it should? Or is there a bit of tactical voting there going on so that people don't get too excited, maybe? Or does it not work like that? How does it work, Simon?
What you're thinking, that basically they sat there, they all had a meeting and they said, right, we're going to need two of you to vote for a rise.
Do you know what I mean?
But it makes it look like we're not going to immediately cut rates.
Yes.
Who wants to do it? And everyone just sat there very quietly.
Everyone points
Nobody
at the
put
hawks
their
and
hands
goes,
up.
You.
And then Andrew Bailey said, right, that's it. Everybody's names go in a hat, apart from mine. And then they drew them. I'm actually pretty sure that's how the MPC works.
Do you think so?
Yeah, that's my understanding. Look, they look at the data. It's data dependent. Data dependent is one of the favourite phrases here. And they will have looked at what's going on in the economy. They will have looked at what's going on with inflation. They will have looked at everything else. I'm surprised personally that two members of the MPC voted for a rise. I think that the full impact of all of the rapid rises that we saw up until August last year have not actually filtered through yet. We've still got about 1.6 million people this year coming off fixed rate mortgages who are facing very large jumps in their mortgage payments, despite the fact that mortgage rates have come down somewhat from the peak that they were at. So I don't think this is fully filtered through. I also think that we often talk about mortgages, we often talk about savings, we don't always talk about the impact on businesses. Businesses have seen their borrowing costs go up substantially, and we have seen the most profit warnings for a very, very long time recently. So I don't think that everything is as rosy as it seems and necessitates raising interest rates twice. Now, what I also think is interesting is that six members of the MPC are saying, no, we should hold on. They're saying we should hold on this month. Bank of England opened the door to interest rate cuts this year, but I think is very, very keen to stress, like the Federal Reserve is in the US, that it is not in a rush to cut interest rates. Markets, even after yesterday, still think that the Bank of England is going to cut interest rates multiple times this year. Before yesterday, we were talking four times. Now we're talking three to four times. I don't see why the Bank of England would cut interest rates three to four times this year. Maybe we might get one cut, you know, just for good measures. But having spent so many years in the doldrums, having spent so many years not able to put up rates because they were so worried about it, and then rapidly raising them by so much, and knowing about the damaging effects of super low interest rates, unless the economy completely goes to pot or inflation drops through the 2% target and then keeps dropping and starts heading down below 0%, which is not what the Bank of England thinks is going to happen at the moment, I just don't see a scenario why they would cut interest rates aggressively this year.
Why, Simon? I mean, why not just stick around 5%? Let us all get a bit used to that, and that then becomes the normal, the new normal. Why is there any need to bring it down? To where?
Well, if you look at the Monetary Policy Committee's remit, it is to get inflation on target at 2%, there or thereabouts. They don't have to hit it bang on all the time, which is lucky because they don't. And also to look after the economy, right? Now, what they've got to do is they've got to look at the base rate where it is, or the base rate where it could be if they move it, how that will affect inflation, how that will affect the economy. What the Bank of England is saying is that rates where they are should bring inflation back down to 2% by April. Then they think inflation is going to probably dip below 2%, but it's not going to go too far below 2%. So if they thought it was going to plummet below 2% and head down back into, 0% territory, and we're going to start worrying about deflation again, then you could see them cutting rates. Maybe by, a quarter point and then another quarter point and then another quarter point. That's not what they're saying is they think is going to happen. Now, what they're saying is they think if they stay at 5.25%, maybe give one cut this year, that's the opening the door kind of thing, very non-committal. Inflation should be around the target. So then the question becomes the secondary thing that the Bank of England is meant to be doing with the MPC. What about the economy? And if you look at the economy, I think they're looking at it and going, I reckon we could probably settle around the 5% mark, and the economy will be okay. I don't think that the data indicates that we are in so much trouble that we need to aggressively cut rates, nor does the data indicate that we are still going to have a major inflation problem, so we need to raise rates. The data indicates that we're probably there or thereabouts, and we probably don't need to cut them by much.
Lee, apart from savers, should we be worried?
Worried about what, Georgie?
Higher for longer and forever.
I don't but we so basically
Rates.
the rates, mate, rates.
Rates, Lee. Mortgages.
So
Borrowing.
the Bank of England, as Simon says, the target for inflation is 2%. Now, Bank of England is now saying that it thinks it's going to meet this target in April as the impact of previous hikes sort of takes effect. But then it's sort of forecasting it to nudge back it up again by the year end and will remain above the bank's target until 2027. That's quite a long forecast of inflation being above its target. So should we be worried about higher rates for longer? Well, not necessarily, but it has been a bit of a difficult time for mortgage borrowers, as we've discussed many times on this podcast. People that have come off of ultra low fixed rates and facing much higher mortgage costs. Now, what's happened so far this year is that there has been some competition amongst the big lenders. So we have seen mortgage rates fall back somewhat. We can get sub 4% rates again, that kind of thing. But there are little signs in recent days that things aren't as rosy as they were looking. That competition has obviously been quite strong. We have seen Santander nudge rates higher. We've seen Nationwide nudge rates a little bit higher, linked to higher swap rates rather than what's happening solely to base rate. But still way off the highs we sort of saw last summer, when we were seeing average rates around about 6%, which people just, very fast for people to have gone from perhaps 1 or 2% to 5, 6% on their mortgage. So you can understand it from that viewpoint, but it feels like there's been a lot of pricing in on what's going on with base rate anyway. So if you go back to November, you could get 6.2% on a 1 year fix, that NS&I bond, which was actually in the end the peak of the savings market. You can now get 5.16%. It's quite a big fall quite quickly. That's the best buy for a 1 year fix, and easy access at around about the same rates. This week we saw NS&I cut its green bond Which is a three-year fix, bit of a niche term. Not many people really take out a three-year fix, but quite a lot of people probably were tempted into that because it was paying 5.7%. It's actually not a bad rate of interest whatsoever. That's been cut twice since then, and this week it's fallen to 2.95%. That's a big old cut to that rate, and it's a kind of sign of what's been happening in savings rates overall. So it feels like the real peak rates came in the autumn. If you were fixing there, you've probably done very, very well. But there's still a number of accounts that beat inflation, which is very, very important. And if inflation is forecast to fall back in the next couple of months, there's going to be a lot of savers that are actually beating inflation by quite some way for the first time, especially that 6.2% 1 year fix. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, I would argue. But it feels like everything has steadied a little bit. You know, we got used to, I think, 18 months of mortgage rates sort of on a bit of a roller coaster. And wasn't quite sure what was happening from 1 month to the next, to be quite frank. And everything has settled a little bit, largely, I would say, because of the pauses in the base rate. And this does look like the peak of the current cycle. But the question, as you say, is what's going to happen throughout the rest of the year? So the Santander results were out this week, and one of the biggest lenders in this country. And basically, they're saying that, you know, they're a little bit more cautious on where they think rates are going to be falling. And maybe it won't be as quick as what's being sort of discussed. We were talking about six cuts potentially this year. That seems to be rowing back a little bit. And at the moment, the markets are betting that they could fall from May and drop as low as 4.25% by the end of the year. That doesn't feel as quite as hard and harsh as what we were hearing kind of a couple of months ago.
Yeah, especially Lee. I mean, I'm thinking now of people trying to get on the property ladder. We had a slight uptick, didn't we, in house prices month on month in January. Movement as well, if you're a seller. But it's a bit, I guess, of a concern of affordability still an issue with rates so high.
Yeah, affordability is always going to be the issue anyway, isn't it? Once you're over that deposit hurdle. And you don't want to end up borrowing more than what you can possibly, you know, you don't want to bite off more than you could chew. Yeah, that's why the affordability kind of criteria is out there. But yeah, house prices are kind of a bit like, I think I said this to someone recently. I don't know if I said it on the podcast, but it's a bit like a cockroach, you know.
Yeah, just, we've said this on the pod, yeah.
You can't stamp it. It just keeps on, it keeps on staying alive. The embers are still there and, you know, people are still buying homes, you know, not as much as what they were. But it's the whole demand supply issue. But yeah, in terms of affordability, you know, we could argue till the cows come home, you know, just how difficult it is for especially first time buyers to get onto the property ladder, given that house prices have been, you know, quite high and wage growth not necessarily rising at the same time. So there are, of course, those kind of considerations. But I still think that it's probably a little bit less scary of a time than it was last summer when it comes to buying a home, because mortgage rates really were swinging all over the shop.
Weren't they just? But don't speak too soon, Lee. You never know what could happen. But Simon, from an investor perspective, what does all of this mean?
Just quickly before we get on to the investor perspective, I'll just make one small point on this whole housing market thing and why this matters so much.
Please do.
We moved in July 2020, right? And if we bought our house now for the exact same price as we paid for it in July 2020, which you wouldn't be able to do because obviously house prices have gone up since July 2020 by quite a bit in the pandemic boom, it would cost us about £550 a month more on our mortgage at current best rates than it did on the rate that we got then. And actually, weirdly enough, the same lender is offering the best buy rate as we actually have our mortgage with. So it's almost a directly comparable scenario. And I think this is the thing that's important to look at when you look at what's going on with the property market, is this is being felt across the board. And you also have to factor in the fact that those houses are now more expensive than they were back then. So actually, people are having to pay even more to buy them. And this is why the property market is struggling. And we have seen house price reports show that there has been an uptick. But what we also have to remember is two of the major house price reports showing an uptick come from mortgage lenders. They come from Halifax and they come from Nationwide, and they are based on their mortgage completions. They're very, very detailed because Halifax and Nationwide are so big that they have a huge pool of data to draw on. But that mortgage lending and the amount that people can borrow from Halifax or Nationwide to buy a house is influenced by the mortgage rates that Halifax and Nationwide are offering. And on the basis that average mortgage rates have come down by about 1% from their peak, on the basis that we've seen these aggressive cuts, on the basis that both Halifax and Nationwide have been involved in these aggressive cuts since last kind of autumn time, you would expect a Halifax or a Nationwide borrower to be able to pay more for a house. So there is a chicken and egg scenario here, isn't there? You know, which one is coming first? So you would expect these indices to show a slight uptick. If you go look at the actual property market where people are trying to sell houses or buy houses at the moment, I don't think it looks quite as rosy as those property indices make out. But to answer your question on investors, this is where it's very, very interesting, because investors are quite reliant for the returns that they have had over the past year or so on the idea that rates have peaked and also rates are going to be cut quite a bit. The sugar rush that we saw at the end of 2023 in markets, where markets fell and then they bottomed out at the end of October 2023, and then they saw a really, really strong end of year rally, particularly for some stocks in the FTSE, and particularly for the S&P 500 in the US, driven by the Magnificent Seven. And this is this expectation that the Fed is going to cut rates by quite a bit. And so it's not the Bank of England that we're worrying about here. Global investors are not worrying about what the Bank of England is going to do. And the Bank of England is probably not going to cut until the Fed cuts anyway. But there is this expectation that the Fed is going to cut. There was, until this week, the markets were expecting the Fed to start cutting in March. That's been pushed back to May now. But markets are expecting the Fed to cut quite a lot of interest rates. And again, you come back to this question of why would the Fed do that? Because the US economy is doing much better than the UK economy is. So they have even less incentive to aggressively cut rates, because why would they need to? In fact, over there, if they aggressively cut rates, you would run the risk of the economy starting to overheat again. There's a question as to whether the economy is too hot in the US with rates where they are. So I think that there is potentially quite a big opportunity for investors as a whole to be disappointed this year by the fact that these rate cuts don't come. And that's something that people need to think about in terms of what could happen to markets. How much of the froth on top of, you know, global markets as a whole is coming from expectations, perhaps misplaced, that interest rates are going to be cut aggressively this year. I mean, I could very well be wrong here, though. That's just my opinion. And, you know, people who bet against the US market and bet against the Magnificent Seven last year ended up making nowhere near as much money as they could do. The safest thing to do, as I always say, is put on your sensible shoes and just buy a global stock market tracker. But if you don't want to do that, then, and you want to be thinking a bit more about some of this stuff, then, you know, some of the more contrarian investors and fund managers out there are saying you need to be looking at stuff that is cheap, that looks cheap, is still undervalued, has some room to rise and has a potential catalyst to rise, rather than just buying into the stocks that are expensive. Magnificent Seven stocks are expensive. Expectations are very high. We saw some results this week from Microsoft in particular, and Tesla as well, that disappointed investors and the shares fell heavily. Whereas if you look at some companies, for example, particularly in the UK, they still look pretty cheap. And I did an interview this week with a value investor, Ian Lance of Temple Bar Investment Trust. And he is a man whose trust backs such exciting cutting edge companies as BP, Royal Mail's owner IDS, Marks and Spencer, which has done very, very well recently, and Stellantis. which is the car making conglomerate that includes everything ranging from Fiat to Vauxhall to Peugeot to Alfa. And he said is astonishingly cheap. And I said to him, well, why would you buy that? You could have bought Tesla. To which his answer was, well, Tesla's really expensive and this is really cheap. And, you know, they've got a plan and maybe they won't deliver on it. But if they do deliver on it, then you could see some good returns. But as I said, often the best thing to do is put on your sensible shoes and just buy a global stock market tracker.
I'm going to use that. Putting on my sensible shoes. All right, then. And now, do you have a smart meter? If anyone would have something that can monitor your energy usage in ridiculous detail, potentially help you save money, then it would be our Lee as he pulls the zip up of his warm gilet. But no, Lee's now shaking his head. He'd rather stick on that extra jumper and warm gilet and leave the thermostat on 19. Lee, you'd be so proud. I'm looking at my thermostat. It's at 16 at the moment. I wonder why it's feeling cold. Anyway, but why? Why is Lee so anti-smart meter? Lee, you've typed your latest piece about this. Tell me more.
I wondered why there was icicles coming off of your... Yeah, it's really cold. I mean, that's even later. Yeah. To be fair, I always put mine on about 16 during the day because, you know, it's during the day and it doesn't...
Yeah. I didn't mean to.
But before I wade into this and the smart meter stuff, you know, they are fully Marmite. I understand that. You know, some people are really, really, really against them and some people absolutely love them. They love them so much that, you know, they really do monitor the pounds and pence as is sort of hammered home in the advertising around it. I'm more on the side of I just don't see the point of them kind of camp. And so I've written this this column piece this week sort of saying that. The reason why I wrote this piece actually is because we've had a number of readers get in touch with smart meter problems over the last couple of weeks in which they have faulty smart meters and they're finding it really difficult to get them fixed, get them repaired, to get their energy supplier to listen and say, actually, I don't think these readings are correct. And when you're in that kind of camp, it's quite frustrating if you can't manage to basically fix the problem. And also the Octopus Energy boss, Greg Jackson, actually criticised in-home displays for smart meters on social media, on X, formerly Twitter, recently. Mm. We've had a million such sessions looking at these darn things. They're so bad. And I actually think hats off to him for being honest. You know, he's not completely towing, I think, the company line there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if something does go amiss, it's really difficult to fix. So for that reason,
just a question there, Lee. Yeah. Is it something that's going wrong now with the machines? Or is the problem the fact that actually they're always going wrong, but the problem is it's just difficulty getting them fixed now? Do you see what I mean?
I think there's a combination of everything, right? So the technology is starting to get quite dated now. You have the SMETS 1 devices, the SMETS 2 devices. Yeah. You had all of that argument that was going on, you know, whether or not you can change energy supplier and then they can use the same smart meter, all of that kind of stuff. It's got quite complex, quite complicated, I think, for the average household. So for that reason, I think that, yes, I think some of these are starting to get dated a bit old and are starting to not kind of function properly. And I think the latest stats were there's 3.2 million smart meters that have gone dumb, you know, that aren't working. That's an incredible number of smart meters that are out there that people just aren't using. I'm happy to once a month submit my energy, my electricity meter and my gas meter, and I've never had a problem with it and everything's been accurate and it's been absolutely fine. I cannot imagine the world in which I have a smart meter that sends off readings every half an hour and I'm standing there looking at our energy usage. And actually, Georgie, every year we get an annual statement from our energy supplier. It comes up with little bars, shows you how a little bar graph of how you compare to similar sized properties. And we're always under the average. So it's not like I think that we get a smart meter. And as me as a consumer, that's going to do anything that's going to change my life. I don't think I'm all of a sudden going to go, oh, yeah, we're spending a couple of pence more now than we are at other points of the day. I just don't, you know, as a consumer, I just don't think it has a huge amount of use to me. And then, you know, one thing that definitely gets most of our readers hot under the collar is standing charges. Now, standing charges for me have gone up around about 200% in 8 years. I mean, that's a large, massive rise in standing charges. And a lot of that you know, not a lot of that, but that's where smart meters are being paid from. You know, it's been soaked into our bills from basically higher standing charges. So there is a cost to it. And I think that's what gets me, again, a little bit annoyed when sort of, you know, the powers that be say smart meters are free. Well, it's not technically strictly true. Some people will say, well, I like the smart meter for the demand flexibility service. That's where energy firms will pay you for swapping around your energy usage. Again, don't think it really benefit me. I'm quite often not in those peak hours anyway. So no, that doesn't really tempt me in. But there is one way that I might be tempted into a smart meter.
Go on, Lee.
One way. I am currently toying up getting solar panels on the home.
Oh, wow.
We're in a relatively sunny part of the UK. Our garden is south facing, so if we got solar panels, they would go on the back of the house, not the front of the house, so wouldn't ruin that kind of curb appeal. And I think actually we probably are in a good location for solar panels, and I've started to consider potentially getting them. The big thing is you don't have to have a smart meter for solar panels. I've had a look into this, but it is a way of kind of monitoring how much energy you're actually creating. And for that reason, I might just about be tempted if I get solar panels, maybe. But that's a big maybe. There's a lot of buts, and it's a lot of the sort of one of those things I'm sort of considering it. But how many months, years, decades will it be until I actually take the plunge get solar panels? But I think it's the only way really that I'd be tempted. But as I say, look, lots of people out there love their smart meters. If you're listening to this and you love your smart meters, that's great. I mean, you know, there's lots of examples out there. So if it works for you, it works for you. Great. If you're on the fence, you know, go and look at the pros and cons. If you're completely anti-smart meter, well, that's entirely your choice. And I think that's the thing. It has to be your choice. I hate it when things get sort of pushed onto us. You have to have a smart meter. And I guess my parting shot on this is I am fed up of just a constant barrage of phone calls and text messages from my energy supplier or whoever they've outsourced this to constantly. The language around it is like, we've got spaces available to fit your smart meter. It's like, hold on, have you?
We'll but not to fix it.
Yeah. Not to actually, like, you know, like fix it, but to put it in. But and that's it, isn't it? Like, you know, these energy suppliers are under kind of a lot of pressure to hit installation targets. I don't know about targets and actually keeping them all live and working properly.
You know, the reality is, Lee, I think that by the time you ever do come round to thinking about a smart meter, the technology would be so different. Might even call it something else. I don't know. I just don't think that this is, it's always seems so beta. We're always so behind. Simon, you're a big fan of smart meters, aren't you?
Yes. And welcome to a new This Is Money podcast segment where, if we're being generous, personal finance expert Simon Lambert helps you learn from his mistakes. Or if we're being unkind, Simon Lambert exposes himself as the country's worst personal finance expert, who is completely incapable of following what he says you should do and instead does the complete opposite. So yeah. I've got a smart meter. I like my smart meter. Do you know why I like my smart meter at the most basic level?
Because this is a new smart meter, not the one that was stuffed in a cupboard.
We need to differentiate here between things. A smart meter is the thing that is like the equivalent of your electricity or your gas meter, and that basically shows how much you've been using, sends the information to your energy supplier, and then you get billed on it. A smart meter device is the thing that you look at and tells you how much energy you are using or not using, okay?
Got it.
So the first bit of learn from my mistakes, aka country's worst personal finance expert who doesn't do what he should do, when I did get a smart meter, you are right, the little device thing got plugged in on the side in our old kitchen, and it sat there for approximately half a day, at which point I needed to plug my phone in. And it was the place where we plugged our phone in. There wasn't anywhere else to plug it in. So it got unplugged and it got put in a cupboard, and that's where it stayed ever since. And it probably went to the tip when we moved. My actual main point here is the reason why I like my smart meter is because I am completely incapable of taking meter readings and supplying them to my energy provider. I have proven this over many, many years, when despite all of the reminders that they send me and the fact that, if I'm going to be entirely honest and fair to energy suppliers, they have made it substantially easier to do this over my adult life, I have totally failed to do it and then regularly get presented with a whacking great big bill because they've been estimating that I'm using X and actually I've been using Y, and somehow that never seems to work in my favor and I get money back. Instead, I always end up owing them money, and then it's like, oh, bugger, I need to find £400. Ever since I had a smart meter, that situation stopped because I get billed for the energy that I use every month. Big fan of that. And there was a period when my old smart meter went dumb when I moved energy supplier, thus illustrating some of the problems that Lee has identified with smart meters. And I went back to having to supply meter readings. And you'll never guess what happened over that period of time.
What?
Yeah, obviously, I didn't supply the meter readings and I ended up back with the same old problem. I'm quite happy with my smart meter. What I'm also quite happy about is that my smart meter allows me to see how much energy that I am using. Not in a, I'm monitoring it on the side. We've got a lot more plug sockets now. Still can't be asked for that. But I can log into my account and I can see how much gas and electricity I've been using month on month. And I had to use this for a practical scenario recently, whereby we've basically done a load of work on the house. We've effectively built a house, right? And I suddenly thought, it's meant to be much more efficient. We've got lots of insulation, got underfloor heating downstairs, got a smart thermostat and everything like that. But I suddenly thought, I hope all this stuff is working properly. What if it isn't working? Because we had a few problems with the smart thermostat because we didn't have the internet connected yet. It's like, what if we're actually spending an unbelievable amount of money and I'm suddenly going to get a massive bill? Oh, no. So I logged on to my Octopus Energy account and I looked it up and it was fine. We weren't using an unbelievable amount of energy. We were using an unbelievable amount of energy compared to when the house had been pretty much knocked down and we weren't using any gas or any electricity. And in fact, the gas was disconnected. But we are only using as much energy as we were same time last year or a little bit less. And so I was reassured. And every month my bills are right. So there you go. That's my defense of smart meters. I can understand why some people don't like them. I can definitely support the cause of not forcing them upon people. But personally speaking, I'm very happy with mine.
Right. That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Rob Morgan of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained section. Interest rates were held again this week on both sides of the Atlantic by the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England in the UK. Now, we know that matters to savers and borrowers due to the rates that they get paid and the rates that they pay, but it also matters to investors. Rob, why do investors worry about interest rates?
As well as dictating what you pay for borrowing money yourself and what banks pay you for saving money, interest rates are really important for investments and the pricing of assets more broadly. Why is that? Well, high interest rates set a higher bar for returns from shares, bonds, or other investments. If you can get high return risk-free from cash when interest rates are high, then you're going to want an even greater return from taking the risks involved with investing. So if expectations for interest rates rise, then asset prices will generally fall to reflect that, all else being equal, simply because investors demand that their return is higher going forward, and that means paying a lower price for those assets. Expectations of interest rates falling have the reverse effect. So with less return on offer risk-free from cash, say, the earnings or the cash flows from investments look more attractive, and investors would be more willing to pay up for them. It's also important to understand that individual businesses that have debt are also going to be directly affected by increases or decreases in their own borrowing costs from higher or lower interest rates, just as any household with a mortgage can be affected. So changes in interest rates can either increase or reduce profits. So the level and the type of debt and the sensitivity to interest rates is something that stock pickers need to take account of when they are weighing up companies to invest in. Now, right now, we're in a situation where interest rates have risen sharply to control the high inflation that we've seen since the pandemic, but they're probably at their peak and they're going to start coming down on the other side. So the timing and the magnitude of that trajectory lower is uncertain, and that in itself causes volatility in market prices, even on a day-to-day basis, as those investor expectations ebb and flow.
Thank you very much, Rob.
Welcome back. Most experts agree that as a nation, we need more personal finance education. Well, that's great for the kids, but what about us who didn't get any? Well, you've been speaking to a money expert, pensions expert no less, who has given you six real-life maths lessons to make us richer when we get older. I have to say, this is not the sort of sexiest of sections we've ever proposed on the podcast. A maths lesson. My brother's a maths teacher, so my dad is a physicist. So by rights, I should be good at maths. But like most of the nation, or lots of the nation, I just sort of glaze over a little bit. So I'll try not to in this section. Who's going to give us the maths lesson?
I'll do it, but I'll
really
quick.
Go on, Simon. Okay. No, just be entertaining. I don't mind speed. Entertaining.
Okay, podcast listeners, it's now time for double maths.
Woo-hoo!
This is a special podcast where instead of being the usual length, it's actually an extra hour and 20 minutes long because we're going to talk all about maths. Maths is fun, kids. Maths is important, actually, and just the basic grasp of it is very important. And actually, one of the main things I would say to people is get your head around percentages, because there's a surprising number of people who don't have a grasp of percentages and will walk into a shop and the shop will tell you that it's 30% off and they don't really know what 30% off is. Sounds good, but what is it? But anyway, in terms of getting richer, number one, compound growth. This is the snowball effect. The snowball rolling downhill. Every time it rolls around, picks up a bit more snow, picks up a bit more snow, picks up a bit more snow, and gets bigger and bigger. The same thing happens with your savings and your investments. You earn returns upon returns, whether that's interest, dividends, or capital growth. And it means that over the years, your money starts to grow at a much faster rate. And there's a really, really nice bit of this where you get to the point where all of a sudden, doing something for 40 years instead of 30 years doubles your money. So compounding, that's good maths. Charges, this is where compounding works against you. This is why you need to be concerned about something that's charging you 1.5% rather than 0.75%. It's really difficult to get people interested in this because 1.5% just sounds like hardly anything at all. But 1.5% of your savings or your investments, your pension, whatever, year after year after year, adds up to a lot. So if you've got a fee of 2%, then after 20 years, you could lose £8,826 to charges. Whereas if you had 0.5%, you'd only lose £2,429 to charges. Tax relief, another bit of handy maths. This is a boost to your pension that you get. So if you, the principle is that you basically pay into a pension out of untaxed income, which means that if you put some money into your pension, then unless you do it through your employer, through a salary sacrifice system where it just comes out before you get paid, you put your money in and you get an immediate 25% uplift, right, onto your pension. And this is to take you back to the position that you would have been in before 20% basic rate tax. The reason why it's a 25% uplift is because to get back from 80 to 100, you need to add £20, and £20 is a quarter of 80, which is a 25% uplift. People quite often struggle to get their head around, I've paid 20% tax, why do I get a 25% uplift? And it's because it's getting you back to the point where you started at. If you're a higher rate taxpayer, you'll get more than that. Remember that if you are a higher rate taxpayer, you need to claim this through your tax return. Unless your work is doing it for you, check with your work, claim it through your tax return. Inflation, right? This is something you need to think about. It's all very well having your savings or investments growing by 5% a year, but what's the inflation rate? What's happening to the value of that money? We are now in a position where savings rates are lower than they were back in autumn time. So that blockbuster NS&I 1 year fixed rate savings account paying 6.2%. Now the best 1 year fixed rate savings account pays 5.16%. But That is now beating inflation, whereas for most of last year, even a 6% savings account didn't beat inflation. You need to be getting a rate of return that beats inflation. And again, inflation, this is where you need to watch out for compounding, because like fees, inflation compounds. And you might think that 4% inflation doesn't sound that much worse than 2% inflation, but if you have 4% inflation for 5 years versus 2% inflation for 5 years, it starts to make a big difference. And then back to percentages. Obviously, it helps when you're buying clothes in sale, but also it helps you understand how much money you're actually putting into stuff. So, for example, auto enrollment, 8% of your salary goes in under auto enrollment. What is 8% of your salary? Do you have any idea what that is? When you are presented with these numbers, look at it and work out, what does this represent to me in pounds and pence? We talked about this the other week. There's a real benefit here, because in order to get a certain amount of money going into your pension, you will only need to put less than that in, because you get that 25% uplift from the government on what you put in, and your work will also put in a certain amount, and many people's employers will match what they put in. So learn about that. And then pound cost averaging. This is when you regularly invest. And as you regularly invest into something, it removes the risk of suddenly losing money because you put a lump sum in, but it also means that over the years, you're buying in at different prices. So when your investments go up, you're winning because your investments go up, but sometimes your investments will go down because they don't always go up. But when the investments have gone down, if you're continually buying every month, you're buying in at a lower price. And when they eventually go back up again, you get a bigger gain, and so on. And that is today's maths lesson finished.
Right. Thank you very much, Simon.
I've got some maths lessons. Can I be the naughty kid in the corner that kind of goes,
Lee,
hold on,
you
this absolutely lesson's not finished.
Can.
I've got questions. Put hand up.
Hand up, please. Thank you.
Chewing gum, blowing bubbles, bubble gum, you know. Yeah. All I was going to say is...
you did the bad kid differently to me.
Yeah, yeah.
But I wouldn't be asking questions in a maths...
Being a bad class. Kid in a maths lesson and going really back to this. So you think about maths at school... and the drudgery of it. There was so much kind of algebra and stuff that just you don't use in your everyday real life. But I look back now and I think, actually, I wish there was more personal finance education in school. Yes, you can look that through now, the jobs that we do. But I think it's so much easier bringing examples of things like percentages to life when you're talking about actual real life examples rather than complex algebra that you just never end up using. Now, an example of this is that my wife will constantly say, I hate maths, or I'm not very good at maths. And actually, when we first got together, this is going to sound really boring, but I taught her how to do percentages, basically, and how I do it. And that's, if you can work out 10% of anything, you can then work out any kind of percentage. So it's just really simple, because if you can work out 10%, you can then work out 1%. And she uses it all the time now. She's like, I can't believe I wasn't taught that in school. It was such a simple thing.
Lee's language of love.
It is, no, but in all seriousness, it took like half an hour, and then she's like, I don't know how I've never been taught that, or how I know that. And the other thing I was going to say, actually, I don't really remember an awful lot from maths. I don't think I took a lot away from it. All of my maths and my sort of mental arithmetic were learned in two ways. One of them was playing darts. I learned so much quick maths playing darts. That I could go to a dartboard and work it out very, very quickly, way more than I learned in a maths lesson. And the second one is playing the computer game Football Manager. Now, if anyone's listening to this and is a Football Manager fan, they'll know exactly what I mean. It taught me how to budget. It taught me how to, work out the cost of things.
And maybe football clubs should play that.
So much more of those two, doing those two things in a maths point of view than I did anywhere else. But the beauty of now being a parent is my five-year-old, I've just bought some maths books, actually, weirdly, this week, because she wanted to do a little bit more maths, when she's keen to go and sort of strike while the iron's hot. And it's actually really interesting, imparting how you do things on your children and how to work things out. And it's one of those things that if you are someone that says, I'm bad at maths, or, I don't like maths, you don't need to like maths. No one likes maths, really, unless you're a real mathematician and you're a wizard at it, and you kind of, find it fascinating, kind of getting into deep, complex algebraic sums. That's fine. But I would just think, in your everyday life, where do you need maths and where can you improve? And usually it's just a couple of small areas that it takes a couple of hours and you go, God, I wish I knew that before.
So that was the, I guess, the the nuts and bolts of finances, it's the maths. Now we get to the emotional side of finances. You know, this is what it really means. It means that if you overspend on a joint bank account and your partner gets unhappy and you get unhappy, it causes problems. So you have the money psychologist couch time on your website. Who wants to take this one?
Sorry, I was trying not to giggle there.
I was trying to be sensitive there, Lee.
It was very sensitive, George.
Change of tone.
I almost felt like I was sitting back on the couch and you were the kind of, you know, giving out the advice. So yeah, it's a new section. It's a new column that's by Vicky Rain.
Well, I like this one because I have, for the first time in my life, just opened a joint account. So yeah, maybe so... Simon's face there.
I hope you understand percentages, Frost. Yeah. Just to be clear to everybody listening, she hasn't opened a joint bank account with me. That's not why I'm warning her.
It's true. I've not. Lee.
No, I've just been a voice of reason, I think. So a question that's been written in here is, my husband and I have a joint bank account since we were married 20 years ago. It's such an area of tension that is undermining an otherwise happy relationship, and we have two young teenagers. My husband is the main earner in the family, where my job doesn't allow for much more than paying for the running of the household and holidays. But I do like to spend money on our daughters, and I like to get my hair cut every few months and buy clothes each season. I read this and I felt a bit sad, actually, in a way. So I think that this might be a bit of a generational thing, perhaps, and that people kind of, maybe older generations felt like, you know, you have a joint bank account and it's all kind of, you know, that's how things are run. But I'll be quite frank, Georgie, in my own life, we have a joint bank account. It is the most chaotic joint bank account on planet Earth. So our mortgage payment comes out of it. And all of our bills come out of it. And it's with a bank that neither of us have as our main account. So I have a main account. My wages get paid into. Wife has a main account. Her wages get paid into.
Me too.
We earn relatively the same amounts of money. It's just quite easy, isn't it? Like, wife pays for some things that are kind of like joint, like shopping and, you know, food shop and that kind of thing. Sometimes I will. Sometimes she'll pay for the petrol in the car. Sometimes she'll pay for the petrol in the car. And it's just kind of quite simple, rather than, I think, trying to run everything through one big joint account. But I know people are different, and lots of people would like to get all of their, you know, both partner salaries paid into an account. Perhaps only one partner has a salary, and it's important that you have that joint account. But I kind of resent that feeling of every single transaction is, unless you've got a real spending problem and it's becoming an issue in which, you know, you're going overdrawn and you're struggling to make ends meet, then I can understand it. But I mean, getting your hair cut every few months and buying some clothes for your daughters, should that really be kind of poured over?
It's really difficult to, unless you've got two people who, I mean, for my situation, it's very easy. I don't have kids. You know, I'll have my money go into my account and damn it, I'm going to pay for whatever I want to and not have to explain it to anyone. Exactly, I've got a joint account for bills, but I'm lucky that I do earn my own money to be able to do that. I don't have to look after kids or do anything like that. It's so complicated. Lee, what was the answer?
It's a complicated one. Without knowing all the ins and outs of the relationship and knowing really like what is being spent. But I guess my best advice in these kind of scenarios is to sit down and have a look from a month-to-month basis where kind of cash is going and where money's going. And if you feel like you're overspending in a certain part of your life, you know, eating out or on clothes, you have a grown-up adult conversation. I mean, if you've been married for a couple of decades, I think it should be fairly simple and straightforward to say, listen, look, I think actually the last couple of months we've spent a little bit too much on clothes and the kids are outgrowing them really quickly. Is there any way we can kind of, you know, maybe make some of this money back by selling some of this and maybe thinking about, you know, cleverer ways to maybe not shop at this shop, but maybe go to this shop? But it can get all very kind of in the weeds, you know, it can get quite difficult. And that's why we've always had separate accounts. We've never even had a conversation about having a joint account in which we do all our everyday spending in, because, you know, I think it can get quite, I don't know, you kind of do start saying, like, my wife went into a supermarket this week and she's like, oh, I spent 90 quid in the supermarket. And I sort of opened the fridge and I was, what have you bought? There's nothing in here, you know, but that came out of her account, so I wasn't so bothered. But if that did come out of a joint account, I might have been more like, where did the money go? And I think that's where quite a lot of the kind of friction can come, because I think a lot of people think they're a better spender than their partner. Like they know how to drive a bargain more or whatever, and it can cause a lot of friction and a lot of problems. But look, I think the number one piece of advice here is just to sit down and have an adult conversation about, you know, and what you can do to perhaps improve the situation. And I know money can often be a sticking point with any kind of relationship. And as I said, we don't know all the ins and outs of this, but I think it's just have a conversation, work out what kind of solution you're going to take to it and take it from there. I mean, Simon might have some better advice than that.
Simon, from maths teacher to psychologist.
Not a trained psychologist.
No, you're not. Well, you're not trained maths teacher.
I'm not even
either,
a trained psychotherapist, which is what Vicky Raynal is. So I'll give you Vicky Raynal's answer.
Oh, all right, then.
Abridged, because I think that's obviously important. And then I'll tell you what I think. Vicky says, it sounds to me as if you and your husband have opted for a joint bank account, like many couples do, in order to simplify life admin, but perhaps without a conversation about values and expectations. So instead of having agreed on what is reasonable or excessive in terms of personal expenses, you keep coming up against each other's different views on this. And when you do, your husband's larger contribution to the family finances might feel, to both of you, like it entitles him to a bigger say in how the family money can be spent. From your email, I can tell the current arrangement makes you miserable because it grants you little financial freedom. As two people come together into a committed relationship and merge not just their lives, but also their finances, this can expose different views, not just on spending versus saving, but also on power and freedom, fairness and equality, transparency and privacy. Often these differences fuel conflict, but if handled well, can be an opportunity to learn about one another in greater depth. I would suggest having a conversation with your husband about how it makes you feel to have your expenses scrutinized. Remember that you are trying to help him understand you, so give him a broader context of why it's important for you to have greater financial freedom. Was your family growing up able to enjoy money in a way that you feel has been lost in your marriage? Or does this dynamic evoke painful memories of watching your father control your mother financially? As you try to understand him and what makes him nervous about your spending, it's worth wondering, what is his family background with money? Did he grow up in scarcity? Pick out some of his family's anxieties related to money, or was there a parent who splashed out money in a way that created financial problems or instigated money conflict in the family? And I think that this is a really important point here, because I think our relationship with money and our family's relationship with money when we were growing up often shapes our relationship with money in future life. And I've personally seen this with many of my friends and the people that I know, you know, people I know very closely. So I have friends who perhaps had money, their families had money, and then something changed and then they didn't have money. Parents split up, and then all of a sudden they had to be much, much more careful with money. I have friends whose families had plenty of money, and but they spent it quite freely. I have friends whose families spent like they had plenty of money, but they didn't have plenty of money. And I've seen the tensions over the years. My personal scenario is that I was lucky when I was growing up in that my mum and dad did have plenty of money, but they were very, very careful about how they spent it. And one of the reasons why they were very, very careful about how they spent it, so we didn't get flashy designer stuff and things like that. We had a nice lifestyle, but it was very, very clear to us that if you wanted something, you asked for it for your birthday or Christmas, and then you weren't definitely going to get it, or you earned it, and that, you know, you spent money on good stuff, but you spent it carefully, you spent it wisely. And again, I think I can trace that back to their own upbringing, which is that they were both, you know, they did well for themselves in life, but they were both working class. So, you know, my mum grew up in a council house. Her parents came over from Ireland in the 50s. And my dad's dad, you know, worked in a factory, factory foreman, but he works in a factory. And, you know, my grandparents on the Irish side, you know, came from Ireland in the early, you know, 20th century. And on the other side came from the East End of London and a Welsh mining village, right? So you can see why, like, there was, you know, even though both sets of those grandparents actually ended up being like quite comfortable in life, there was quite a degree of prudence that then followed through. Now, I think as it goes down through the generations and the generations feel a bit more comfortable, a bit of that prudence goes out the window. So I'm definitely a bit more spendy than my wife is, but I'm also quite conscious about what I spend on. And whilst I will spend money, it has to represent kind of value for money. And I have a quite different attitude in some ways to money to the one that my wife does. And you have to think about, like, where does that attitude come from? Which brings me back to what, you know, I would suggest in this scenario and the way that we've worked things out, but doesn't necessarily work for everyone, is I think a joint bank account is a really good thing, but I don't think you should both have your salaries or your earnings paid into it. I think you do need to have that degree of financial freedom. So the way we've always worked it, you know, when we were both employed, was my salary went into my bank account, wife's salary, you know, before she was my wife, went into her bank account. And then we both put money into the joint bank account that, you know, covered the mortgage, the monthly expenses, the bills, the everything else. And we worked back from that point. So it's like, right, how much do we need for the mortgage? How much do we need for the monthly stuff, et cetera? We both pay that in. At the point when we were both earning the same amount, we paid it in equally. And then the rest of the money is our money for ourselves to spend, save, invest, do whatever. And the joint bank account was for that stuff. But if we were doing things like going out to dinner, you know, buying ourselves clothes, doing all those kinds of other things, we spend it ourselves. Things changed when we had kids. And then you have to think about it differently. And at one point when my wife was on maternity leave, I would actually give her some money every month just so she had some money to spend rather than it being out of the joint bank account, because she's a bit more cautious on spending out of the joint bank kind of thing. And then now I earn more than she does. She spends, you know, time looking after the kids and stuff. So we've kind of divided it up proportionally based on the, like, well, you know, if I earn X and you earn Y, therefore I'll put this percentage in to cover, you know, the larger amount of the monthly amount, and you put in that percentage, and we then still have our own money. And I think that works for us. It doesn't, as you said, it's not going to work for everyone. But I could see why, if you were in a situation where it was all going into a joint pot and then you were spending out of the joint pot, it would definitely lead to tension. But I think that if you are in a situation, as Vicky points out here in a very good answer, you know, to this question, that you need to look at where that tension comes from and talk about it rather than just letting it continually build up.
So have a conversation and start to know thyself, I think. This podcast isn't long enough for me to go into my financial family history, so I will leave it at that. But Lee Boyce, final word from you?
Oh, final word for me. Just to quickly say a really big thank you to all of the listeners that got in touch over the last week about Avios points. We have had so many Avios geeks get in touch with their tips that we're going to turn it around into here's the real experts, the real Avios experts. So keep an eye out for that on the website next week. But some really, really great stuff. So thank you very much for that.
Lovely. All right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past. And if you've got tips for managing the family finances and how you've done this thing with joint accounts or how you work this kind of stuff out, or any thoughts on that, we'd again love to hear from you, and we'll talk about them in podcasts coming up. So email us at the address that I just mentioned, put the word podcast, start the subject line, and then, you know, household finances or joint bank accounts or whatever. Tell us your thoughts, and we will use them anonymously, of course.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade-in shares, funds, investment trusts and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.